Today is Wednesday, May 31st. We're going to be working on cellular information today. Okay, so we're starting on cell. That is page 28. And the first thing I'd like to do is take you on a tour of cells using a cell scale website. This one is at the University of Utah, actually where I was at a conference last week. And this particular cell scale is something you can access if you'd like to go home and take a look at it. Okay, so what they start you off with is some things that you can probably see with the naked eye and really have probably seen in your lifetime and not really given a second thought to. We're looking at a coffee bean, a grain of rice. You've got Times New Roman, or Times Regular there with 12-point font, sesame seed. And then you start seeing some stuff in the center here that is too hard to see with the naked eye. I mean, you can see it, of course, because when we zoom in just a little bit, you realize that we're looking at a grain of salt right there in the center. And then here's some stuff that actually crosses the barrier from what you can see with the naked eye. Just to give you an idea of scale, we're looking at a grain of salt here that is about half of a millimeter in length. Okay, and as we work this thing in, you're going to notice that we start getting into a smaller scale. That thing that looks like a U is a micrometer. So we're looking at an amoeba that's about 500 micrometers. You may have heard about the brain-eating amoebas. A lot of times they come into our focus during the summertime. These things live in, you know, dirty pond water, standing water that people may swim in, and they crawl up your cranial nerve and your nose and get into your brain. So that's a pretty big cell when you think about the scale that we're looking at. Let's zoom in a little bit more, and you're now going to see a paramecium, a human female egg, and these are all things that are barely visible to the naked eye, better aided by a microscope. You can see that we've even got some smaller stuff here, skin cells, photoreceptor cells, and you may be able to see that tiny sperm there about ready to fertilize the egg. All right, so as we zoom in, we're definitely dealing with things that are too small to see with your naked eye, red blood cell, X chromosome, and then you see some tiny stuff there in the very center, also too small to see with your naked eye. We're now looking at things like organelles, like mitochondria. You've got some lysosomes. There's nasty old E. coli that can cause major problems in us. We're still dealing on the micrometer scale. That looks like that little upside down, strange looking U. So as we continue along, you may start to see more things come into focus. Viruses are actually rather small, so now we're starting into virus territory, and we're looking at an even smaller scale, not micrometers, but nanometers, something like 10 to the negative 9th meters in terms of size. So it really gives you an idea of the relationships here. As we continue working in, you're going to find ribosomes. There we go, it's nanometers. Some tiny stuff here in the middle. We've got hemoglobin. There's tRNA, transfer RNA. Okay, we'll talk about antibodies and Bio-211. And now some familiar stuff comes into view. Look how small the glucose molecule is. The P stands for pico, which is 10 to the negative 12 meters. That's incredibly small and certainly not something you can see with the naked eye. Adenine, we're going to deal with that one. That's one of those bases for DNA and RNA. And then right here in the very center is a water molecule and a carbon atom. And that's about as far as this cell scale tends to go. But I really like this because it gives you the relationship between stuff you can see versus what you can't see. And it really kind of gives us a relationship between the tiniest stuff and the bigger items. So if you'd like to take a look at this, it is at the University of Utah's website. You can search for cell scale and University of Utah, and this will pop up for you in like a Google search. This is also linked in the course, so if you'd like to go to D2L or into our content, you can take a look at it there. Do y'all have any questions on that cell scale? It is very cool, yeah. So about 400 years ago, there was a man named Robert Hooke. This makes me think of pirates. You know, you hear Captain Hooke, but this is not a pirate. This is actually a guy that was a monk living in a monastery. And I guess he had a lot of time on his hands. You know, all day thinking and praying and whatever else he was doing in the monastery. Well, he was looking at some cork cells, which were likely shoved into a wine bottle through a very primitive, basic microscope. So you'll notice this microscope has, you know, an eyepiece and an objective there, but that's as fancy as it gets. We've got far more complicated microscopes in our labs. And he saw something like this through a microscope. These are teeny tiny rooms in that cork, and he decided to call them what he lived in, which was a cell. So, you know, monks live in cells, tiny rooms. Therefore, these tiny rooms of an organism are also called cells. Nowadays, we can stain them with dyes to make them pop. You know, you can definitely see the walls better here in this picture than you can without the stain. So we now have pink and blue dyes that we use for our plant and animal cells in labs nowadays. This is my disclaimer about the stains. Don't memorize by the color of the stain, because they may use pink for one or blue for another. And if you memorize one of those epithelial or connective tissues by its stain color, then they may choose a different stain for the next picture, and up there goes your clue, right? So I would just want to put that out there as a caution, not to memorize by the stain color. We, of course, eukaryotes, which means that we have a true nucleus. That is different from bacterial cells like you see here. They are called prokaryotes. What do they lack? Yeah, nucleus. So they have no protective device around their DNA. It's just kind of laying there inside the cell, and unfortunately that means it may be subject to attack or change or mutations. So we kind of keep our DNA nicely wrapped inside of a protective nucleus, which we'll talk more about today. In a cheek cell swab, you're going to see three of the most important parts of your cells. You're going to see the nucleus, which looks like a little nut or a kernel in the middle of your cell. You're also going to see the boundary. What is that boundary called? Cell membrane, good. And what is the semi-fluid stuff found inside?
Cytoplasm,
good. So we're going to talk about these three things today. We're focusing first on the nucleus. You may wonder what these other items are. You know what these things are? They look like organelles. Yeah, you'd be totally right in guessing that, but in fact, these are bacteria. So, you know, our mouth is a hot pot for bacteria. And these are rod-shaped bacteria that were living in someone's mouth, so ooh, right? Okay, that's probably more like what you see when you look through a microscope, not the pretty picture that you saw before. Okay, how about any questions so far? We're going to get started on the top of page 28 there with plasma membrane structure. All right, so our plasma membrane is an important part of the cell. I kind of think of it as a boundary around our cell. And by being a boundary, it has to regulate what can come and go through the cell. So let's talk about the structure and relate that to how the plasma membrane or cell membrane works as a boundary. At the very top, you'll notice there is a lipid component of your plasma membrane. The specific type of lipid found here is a phospholipid. That is your blank. Two layers of phospholipids. So I know it's been a while since we talked basic chemistry structure, so let's review. What you have in a typical lipid is a glycerol head right here, and you have two fatty acid chains. Okay, so this glycerol head is actually a little different from your typical glycerol head. It does contain a phosphate group, and you can see that P right there is our reminder that there's a phosphate group in here. So phospholipids have a phosphate group in the head region. The head region becomes polar. All right, this is reaching back in your chemistry info. What does it mean to have a polar region?
Non-equal sharing.
Non-equal sharing, good. So in fact, that polar head is hooked to two fatty acid chains that are nonpolar. What does nonpolar mean?
Equal sharing.
Equal sharing, yeah. So these fatty acid chains, they share their electrons equally. And you'll notice that one of those chains happens to be straight with no kinks or bends. The other one has a single kink in it. So let's see, which one of those is saturated? The straight one, good. And this particular chain has only a double bond, so it is
unsaturated.
Unsaturated, good. to be very specific, since it has only one double bond, would you call it a monounsaturated or a polyunsaturated?
Mono.
Right. Good. So just one double bond there makes this one a monounsaturated. How would you have drawn that chain had you indicated it would be a polyunsaturated? Yeah, at least two double bonds. Yeah, multiple kinks in that chain, lots of double bonds. So since there's only a single, let's see, there's a better way to say that, right? Since there's only one double bond there in that fatty acid chain, there's only one kink. That's why you see just that one bend right there. So when we put it all together, this is what you've got. You've got layers of, two layers to be exact, of phospholipids. Their heads orient out. You'll notice their tails orient in. And here's another layer of heads oriented toward the inside of that cell membrane. So there are, in fact, two layers of phospholipids here. Heads out like the bread of a sandwich and tails pointing in like the meat of a sandwich. So we're going to use that sandwich analogy as we walk through the parts of this phospholipid bilayer. So you may hear this called selectively permeable or semi-permeable. What is it about the heads? Do they like water? Do they hate water?
They like water.
Good. Polar stuff loves each other, right? So water is polar. The heads are polar. So water and the heads get along. So the water and the heads are good friends. The tails were nonpolar. How do nonpolar substances get along with polar?
They don't.
Yeah, there's no love there, right? So those polar, nonpolar tails, rather, and the polar water molecules don't like each other. Therefore, when you look at this phospholipid bilayer, water-based items are kept out of that inside compartment. So that prevents most water molecules or water-based items from traveling through. That's an issue, right? Because we've got about 60% of our bodies composed of water. And where is most of our water stored?
In the cell.
In the cell, yeah. So that's going to be a problem if you've got to get water inside your cell and the tails don't like water. So we're going to have to figure out a way to get the water into the cells, and we'll cover that when we do membrane transport. Okay, so that's what we mean by selectively permeable or semi-permeable. These plasma membranes don't like water-based items, so they're going to exclude water from coming through that phospholipid bilayer. And to be specific, it is the phospholipid tails there that are water-fearing. The word for water-fearing is?
Hydrophobic.
Good. Okay, so far we've covered the phospholipids. In fact, we can go ahead and label them on this picture. Down below, you've got letter B there. That is a phospholipid what?
Head.
Good. And how about letter C?
Phospholipid
tails. Good. Okay, we'll come back. We'll do something else and we'll come back to this. The next major part of your plasma membrane structure is called the protein. And there's a number of proteins that are part of the structure of your plasma membrane. You'll notice on your worksheet that there are two major types. There are integral proteins and there are peripheral proteins. So integral proteins are ones that are found all the way through your phospholipid bilayer. This one here passes completely through that sandwich of phospholipids. Let me give you an example. If you take a toothpick for a really big sandwich and you stab your toothpick all the way through your sandwich, that's what an integral protein does. It travels all the way through both layers of bread and any meat or stuff you have inside your sandwich, and it even pokes out the bottom side of your sandwich. And that's what this integral protein does. Here's another. There's lots of integral proteins here. Some of these integral proteins may behave as channels, simply an open doorway. Some of these may behave as pumps, which kind of work like an elevator. You just don't go and walk on the elevator, right? You have to wait for the doors to open. Those are kind of like pumps. So these integral proteins may behave as doorways called channels or like pumps. So we'll talk more about what they do as we go through both Bio-210 and 211. Now, some of those proteins are found only on one surface. Those kinds of proteins are called? peripheral proteins, good. So right here you'll notice a peripheral protein. Now, how would you know that that is not integral? It doesn't go throughout the whole plasma membrane, right? So it's just sitting on one side or another. So just to kind of give you an analogy, once again, if this is your sandwich, okay, here's your two pieces of bread, right? Okay, those are your phospholipid heads. Let's say that you've got some meat, some tomatoes, some lettuce, all that stuff on the inside. Those are going to be your phospholipid tails. Okay, I just took a fancy toothpick. I stabbed all the way through my sandwich. That fancy toothpick is what type of protein? Integral. Good. So that's an integral protein. And let's say that you take an olive and you stab it through that toothpick, or stab the toothpick through that olive. Right here is going to be sitting an olive. So what kind of protein is that?
Peripheral.
That's peripheral. So I'm going to move my arrow down here for my integral protein so we don't get confused. Okay, so those peripheral proteins don't travel all the way through your phospholipid bilayer. They're simply sitting on one side or the other. And they do not travel like that toothpick does through the entire sandwich of your plasma membrane structure. You'll notice in this picture that some of those proteins are linked up with other stuff. There's one here called a glycoprotein. It's linked up with, guess what? The sugar, yeah. So glyco means sugar, like glucose. So that protein's linked up with the sugar. And they perform all sorts of functions. You'll notice on your worksheet, some of these various proteins that stick out on one side only may serve as receptors or recognition proteins. Others that travel through work as carrier or channel proteins. So it just depends on where you find them located as to what job they're going to perform. So as we get into Bio 211 and we talk about blood typing, some of these surface features on the outside here are going to be important, because that's what drives tissue typing for donors and blood typing for blood transfusions. So this outer surface is actually very important for us in typing tissues. One other issue out here is a carbohydrate chain. You'll notice it's linked up to a protein down below in that case. These carb chains make the external surface of your plasma membrane rather sticky. So that stickiness is great because it helps to keep one cell stuck to the neighboring cell. Imagine if we didn't have a sticky glycocalyx, we would have our cells literally falling apart. So it's a way to keep one cell stuck to a neighboring cell. Okay, so let's go back to our big picture that we were labeling before. We've taken care of letters B and C. All right, can you find for me a carb chain?
A.
A, good. A is a carb chain or carbohydrate chain to be specific. And let's see, can you locate an integral protein?
D.
D, good. And then finally, what is letter E?
Peripheral
protein, good. All right, so let's review. Which one of these letters would represent a protein channel or a protein pump?
D.
D, good. It travels all the way through the entirety of your cell membrane.
What was the question?
What would serve as a protein channel or a pump? Okay. What may serve to stick your cell to a neighboring cell?
Carb
chain. Carb chain, yeah, good. So that letter E stick, or letter A rather, sticking out there would be a great thing to anchor your cell or stick your cell to another neighboring cell. I do want to mention a term that's associated with the stickiness of your cell surface. It's called the glycocalyx, and it should be written there by carbohydrate component on your worksheet. That's just a descriptive name for the sticky external surface of your cell. sell yourself. I'm all about food today. We have sandwiches, we got Jell-O. Okay, so when we talk about cytoplasm at the very bottom of your page, the cytoplasm is what gives your cell shape. Literally translated, cyto is cell. What is plasm?
Matter or substance,
right. And in fact, this is what gives some shape to your cell, and it houses your organelles. It also houses solutes, other items in there that are important for cellular reactions to occur. So it's not just plain water that's inside your cell as intracellular fluid. In fact, the water that's in there is only one component of your cytoplasm. So when we talk about the water inside your cell, we actually call it cytosol, or we call it the intracellular fluid. But keep in mind, that's just one part of your entire cytoplasm. So if you've ever made fruit cocktail in Jell-O, you know, kind of an old thing to do, right? I don't know if anybody does that anymore. But if you put fruit cocktail in your Jell-O, those pieces of fruit actually behave as your organelles would. You know, they're suspended inside your cytoplasm or your Jell-O, and they're in there performing some specific job. So that's kind of the mental image I have of how cytoplasm works to support your organelles. So the point here is you don't have liquid running water inside your cells. You actually have something that's more of a smooth fluid medium, more of a gel-like consistency, just like Jell-O is. All right, so that takes us to the very bottom of page 28. How about questions on that page? So let's talk about organelle structures over on the next page. We're going to hit the nucleus. And some people say the nucleus is not technically an organelle, but it is performing a specific job inside your cell. And that's typically what an organelle is tasked with doing. But it's more than just being a structure or an organelle. Why is your nucleus, this piece right here, so important? Good. It is a control center, right. No nucleus means your cell has no brain, and without a brain, there's nothing to really drive the functions inside your cell. So it is kind of the boss, the control center, the brain of that cell. So I'd like to explain what a nucleus is. It's more than just the DNA inside a structure. The nucleus includes an envelope that wraps on the outside. And it's not just a solid membrane. In fact, this particular membrane has holes known as pores, okay? And if you've ever seen a wiffle ball, this is exactly how the nuclear envelope is constructed. You may wonder why you put your very important DNA inside a structure that's poked full of holes, because that seems counterintuitive, right? If you want to protect something, why give it plenty of holes there? And the reason is for communication. So we're going to use those nuclear pores that look like holes on the wiffle ball there to allow information to travel into your nucleus and, most importantly, out of your nucleus into the cytoplasm. So the nuclear envelope is made exactly like your plasma membrane. It's double layers of phospholipids, but there happens to be pores or holes all over that nuclear envelope. When you look inside the nucleus, you have a condensed region of DNA as well as other DNA laying around in there. So when DNA is in its relaxed state, we have a name for it. It's called chromatin. Right, there you go. And when DNA is condensed in a little region of your nucleus, what do we call that?
Nucleolus.
Good, nucleolus, good. So I've heard it nucleolus, nucleolus. Either way you call it, it's a little condensed region of DNA. And I kind of think of it as that's where the party is at in the nucleus. That's where a bunch of your DNA is hanging out. It's wrapped with proteins, and it makes a little dark spot inside the nucleus, especially when we drop some glue stain on that nucleus. Let's see, there's another thing in this picture that's called nucleoplasm. That name should sound familiar. We just talked about cytoplasm. And so nucleoplasm and cytoplasm are basically the same type of fluid. The name, however, tells you where it's located. So nucleus, good. So nucleoplasm is fluid inside the nucleus. Where is cytoplasm?
Inside the cell.
Inside the cell, right. Is cytoplasm technically in your nucleus, or do we have a different name for it? Different name, yes. So technically, when cytoplasm is inside your nucleus, we're going to call it more specifically nucleoplasm, right? Because we want to differentiate where that fluid is located. But in terms of what it's made of, cytoplasm and nucleoplasm are the same thing. So let me explain it to you this way. You've got air outside your house. You've got air inside your house. It's all air, right? Same concept here. You've got fluid inside your nucleus. You've got fluid outside your nucleus. We just happen to call it two different things based on where it's located. So the fluid inside your nucleus is nucleoplasm. The fluid outside your nucleus that's still in your cell is called
cytoplasm.
Yes. So that's just, it's just a naming thing there. Okay. So why don't we talk about DNA structure a little more in detail? We've talked about this, oh goodness, I think probably last Monday we discussed organic compounds. What is the building block of any nucleic acid? Good, good. Okay, and so those building blocks are nucleotides, and you're exactly right. They are composed of a sugar, at least one phosphate group, and in this case here, up to four nitrogenous bases. Now, since we're discussing DNA, our particular sugar is called deoxyribose. That, in fact, is the D in DNA. By the way, how did you know deoxyribose was a sugar? OS, yeah, that OSE is a great clue. Let's see, the next major portion of a nucleotide is a phosphate group. Phosphate groups contain which element?
Phosphate.
Good, or phosphorus, right. So you've got a P to look for there. And then these nitrogenous bases contain nitrogen. That's why we call them nitrogenous. And there's four bases, adenine, which is represented by A. What about T? What does that represent?
Thymine.
Good. C?
Cytosine.
And G?
Guanine.
Good, good. So instead of talking about this nucleotide and trying to describe its features and this nucleotide, we simply say, hey, what makes a nucleotide different from its neighbor is the base. So we simply say, if your base is A, then that's what we call that particular nucleotide. So that's our naming scheme here, is we pick on which base is in that nucleotide, and that's what we call that particular nucleotide. Okay, so the function here is to look at the arrangements of A's, T's, C's, and G's, and that's going to be a way for us to store our genetic information. So this is the only function of DNA, it's to store genetic info inside your cell. All right, give you a moment to make sure you got your blanks filled in there. So I just want to make sure we're good to go with those terms, chromatin, chromosomes, make sure we understand the difference between those terms. You know, the catch is that DNA can exist in multiple states, and if DNA is in its relaxed state, we simply say it's chromatin. So like I was describing before, it's just a relaxed state of DNA. It's still in its double helix like we normally see, something like this. And it just happens to be relaxed. The cell knows we're not undergoing cell division. So it's kind of like you're home on a Saturday afternoon, no one's in the house but you, and you can run free in your undies, right? And so that's what DNA does when it's in its chromatin state. It's relaxed, it's hanging out, there's nothing happening here. The cell is an interphase when we have it in this chromatin state. All right, so along comes the two other terms there, chromosomes. These things are actually both chromosomes. You'll notice one of them has a top arm and a bottom arm. And because it's only one armed, it's called a single-stranded chromosome. And this one has two arms on top and two arms on the bottom. So what do we call this one?
Double-stranded,
right. So the catch is that, you know, this is a more organized look for DNA. And when you see DNA as a chromosome, we understand that it's ready to undergo some form of cell division, either mitosis or meiosis. So DNA is still DNA as chromosomes or chromatin. All it is for us is a clue as to what part of a life cycle you're in. Okay, so chromatin is interphase, and of course, chromosomes appear when you're doing cell division. So prophase, metaphase, anaphase, telophase. Okay, so just wanted to clarify those terms there. And make sure you've got your next blank. The function, the nucleus is the part of the cell that stores what?
DNA,
good. Structure before we talk about what it's doing inside the cell. We know that DNA is held together by its base pairs. The base pairing rules follow this. Adenines and thymines tend to pair together, or you can say thymines and adenines tend to pair together. Likewise, cytosines and guanines tend to pair, or G's and C's tend to pair. So those bases pair together. They're actually held together by a number of hydrogen bonds. How would you recognize the hydrogen bonds? Dashes, good. So there you go, you've got some hydrogen bonds holding together. There's G's and C's, A's and T's. And the order makes a difference because it tells a story. So just like the words in a sentence are important, their order makes sense, the letters and their arrangement also make a difference. So we're going to talk about these letters here in relationship to protein synthesis in just a little bit. Okay. So near the bottom of your page, I'd like to talk to you about how we copy our DNA. And copying DNA is known as replication. Okay, replication means to copy. Why might you want to copy your DNA?
When cell division happens, you have to put it in another cell.
Good, good. If you need to make new cells, you don't want to give them no brains, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you've got to copy your DNA so that you can give your two new cells, each of them, to have a brain. So we're going to undergo cell replication, or, you know, mitosis. And that involves DNA replication. Replication means to copy. Okay, so replication means to copy. Replication means what? I'm just checking because one of the biggest confusing factors on test number one is replication versus transcription versus translation. Yeah, so replication means to copy your DNA. And all we have to remember is the base pairing rules. What does A typically pair with?
C.
And C pairs with?
G.
Okay, you can keep that straight, then you're good to go. Have you seen the cell cycle before?
Yes.
Okay, so gap 1 or G1, synthesis and G2 are all part of a big phase known as?
Interphase.
Good. We know that the mitosis phases include pro, meta, ana, and telophase. We're going to leave those alone for just a moment, but we're going to pick instead on this portion here called the synthesis or S phase. That is where you perform DNA replication. In other words, that's where you copy your DNA in anticipation of mitosis. Okay, so you copy your DNA during the synthesis portion of interphase. And that's because we're getting ready for or preparing for the upcoming mitosis. Mm-hmm. So DNA is kind of like a zipper, and it's a complicated zipper. Imagine if you had to get undressed with one of these zippers. It's not just zipped up, but it's twisted together like a spiral staircase. If you want to make a copy of this, you've got to first untwist this thing. It takes time, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then you've got to unzip this thing. Okay. Now, that's going to take about 24 hours to do all of your DNA. You've got 23 chromosome pairs, 46 in total. So every time you want to replicate or copy your DNA, you have to untwist it, unzip that DNA, and allow the replication process to begin. So this is something that takes about 24 hours. And after that, we have to check for mistakes. Because if you make mistakes, those mistakes can be passed on to your new cells, and those can ultimately cause big problems like mutations. So we've got to check ourselves after we do the copying process. So in this picture, they've already untwisted the DNA. They have also unzipped it. And they're actually performing the base pairing process to copy that DNA. The copying process involves lining up your base pairs with their complement. So in this picture, you can actually see the complementary base pairs. You'll notice that there's an exposed T and exposed G, but we've already paired up C with G, G with C, T with A, and so forth. If you take a check, it looks like this particular set of DNA has been done just right. There are no mistakes there, which would be called mutations. And unfortunately, mutations can lead to disease. So it looks like we've done the base pairing rules correctly so far. You'll notice that we're unzipping in that direction. We're going toward the top of this picture. So if you were bringing in the complementary base pair for thymine, what would it be?
Adenine.
Good. There's another thymine, would bring in another adenine. What about, let's see, on this side, there's an exposed C. What would you pair that one with?
Guanine.
Good. So as you unzip, there are base pairs being brought in by enzymes. They're going to link up with that backbone and start to create for us two strands. So I'd like for us to be able to practice this. I'm going to give you two parent strands, and we're going to replicate or copy them and write down our own daughter strands. In fact, those are the blanks down here near the bottom of your page. Each double strand of DNA contains an old parent strand and a brand new daughter strand. You is a double-stranded piece of DNA. I've untwisted it and unzipped it, and we've exposed these parent strands so that we can perform complementary base pairing. So what we're going to do now is bring in the complements to each of these parent strands, and I'll help you with the bottom one there. What base pair should go with adenine?
Thymine.
T or thymine. Good. What about with T?
Adenine.
Good. And then we've got
guanine.
Good.
Just make an example of that, it would be great.
That's on the test, so we're good.
Just that.
Just that there. That's 100. There you go. Right. Okay. Let me give you a moment to think about the top strand there. That parent strand is complementary to the other parent strand, right? And that parent strand is going to have a daughter strand built onto it. We're going to use that parent strand as a template. All right, so let's go ahead and build that set of base pairs. We'll start with adenine. I couldn't do that one fast enough. Feel good about that?
Yeah.
Okay. So, what you just did is you turned a single-stranded DNA molecule into a double-stranded DNA molecule. What I find confusing about saying that is DNA itself is a double helix, right? There are, in fact, two strands linked up there together, but here comes two strands, and there comes two strands. So let me get this screen out of the way. Okay, so, you know, when we talked about a single-stranded chromosome, we said it had, like, one arm on the top and one arm on the bottom. And we said a double-stranded chromosome had two arms on top and two arms on the bottom, okay? What you just did is you took what was a single-stranded chromosome and you started turning it into a double-stranded chromosome, okay? And if you keep working in this direction, you're going to do the same thing. You're going to unzip, unbubble those DNA strands, and you're going to end up having an arm up top and an arm over here. So it ends up looking just like that one, which is a double-stranded chromosome. And the cool thing is, when this thing goes through metaphase, what happens to those chromosomes?
They pull them apart.
Yeah. And right through here is your metaphase plate, and you pop one arm toward the top, one arm toward the bottom, and you now have single-stranded chromosomes going toward each brand new cell. So that's the whole goal here, is to copy the DNA during interphase, and then that way during mitosis, you have enough DNA to keep for one old cell and to give to a brand new cell, okay? So if you feel comfortable with base pairing rules, then you're pretty good to go with DNA replication. Would you like another one to practice?
No, that
was good. Check, you're done. Okay. If you would, there is a practice on the bottom of the page. What I've given you is a parent strand, top and bottom, and then you've got an opportunity to write in the daughter strands. I didn't give you a whole lot of space there. I won't go that far.
Okay.
We'll stick with just the basics.
On the
team. You know, I don't know because they cover so much.
What if you ask questions like if you see a mutation?
On the teams.
I didn't get any questions.
Okay. I hear they ask all sorts of crazy stuff on that teams test.
Yeah, there's like some chemistry. Pretty much what we've done so far is on the
T's. I hear it's astronomy, geology, basic bio.
Most of the stuff on the T's is stuff that we've already been exposed to. You may not remember it, but it's stuff that you see, we can like start thinking about it, you might not know the answer.
It's supposed to be from that
grade,
basic knowledge, but some of that stuff.
It was hard.
I did not learn science in high school.
And they're telling me like what layers of the atmosphere and stuff. I've heard that on there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like stuff you know, but
it's gone.
Like,
yeah.
There's a lot of mitosis on stuff like that.
Wow.
I think that's wow.
You guys probably notice there's a built-in self-check when you do DNA replication. If you've got both strands, the daughter strands actually match the other parent strand, right?
Mm-hmm.
So as long as you've got, for the top daughter strand, let's see, you should have T, A, G, T. Good so far?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. If you've got those first four, I figure you're probably well to do with the rest of that thing. That new daughter strand should actually match your bottom parent strand.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so just a way to kind of double check yourself there. I cannot emphasize enough, though, not to use use here. I know that we're getting ready to talk about uracil and use, but that is saved for protein synthesis. That's not what we're currently doing. So what we're currently working on is called DNA replication, and the whole goal is to copy your DNA in anticipation for cell division, which is mitosis. This way, when you divide your cell in half, you've got enough DNA for the old cell and the new cell to each get DNA. Okay. So do you feel like this is something you could do come test day, do a copy?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Any questions, anything I can clarify for you? Okay. Let's see. This is probably a good time to take a break to kind of clean our brains for just a moment. Why don't you come back around 9 o'clock, and we'll start on page 30 at that point. Okay, so when we're talking about protein synthesis, don't forget what the word means, right? What does synthesize or synthesis mean? To make, good. And of course, if we're making proteins, that's the whole goal of protein synthesis. And this, in fact, is a two-step process that occurs inside your cell during interphase. I know the story sounds similar so far to replication, but synthesis does not take place during the synthesis phase. You know how confusing is that, right? DNA synthesis occurs during the synthesis phase, but proteins are actually made during these gap phases, especially during gap one. So when a cell exits telophase, we have two baby cells, right?
Yeah.
Okay. They need to grow up, and they need to add new proteins to their inventory inside their cells. So during this gap one period of interphase is a time when we do experience a lot of protein synthesis, making new proteins and growing that cell up bigger. So this is a time for the cell to grow up during this gap one period. You know, and later on during that cell's life, it's going to get a signal that says, hey, it's time for you to reproduce. Go ahead and duplicate or replicate or copy your DNA, and then it transitions over there into that synthesis phase. So protein synthesis is actually going to take place mostly during G1, which is a growth or a gap period prior to making extra DNA. Okay, so there are two steps to DNA, or sorry, I'm going to do it here to get you confused, right? There are two steps to protein synthesis, transcription and translation. We've got to make two steps here to make our protein. There are two steps. Both of them begin with a trans prefix, and that makes them hard to remember in order, so I want to give you a clue to help you keep them straight. Transcription and translation have to occur in the right order, so if you exclude the trans portion, the first different letter you see is a C and then an L. So alphabetically, transcription comes before translation, okay? So that means transcription is step one. That means translation is step two. Let me tell you another clue. Notice the transcription right there has an R. And translation right there has an A. That's my second clue, because transcription makes RNA. There's my R. And translation, there's my A, makes amino acids. Okay, so a couple of little clues there. Transcription has an R, it makes RNA. Translation has an A, we make amino acids. transcribe a book in Latin into an English book, then you're literally rewriting that book into a new language. When we transcribe DNA into RNA, we are rewriting the language of DNA into a language of RNA. Okay? So it's just rewriting your language. Translation, again, is kind of that same concept of using a different language. And if you're translating, say, German into English, then now you're taking one language and you're speaking it into another one. The same concept here of rewriting languages. So we're going to rewrite our RNA strands into an amino acid setup that we have to use a code chart for us to do translation. So the end result here is ultimately to make a protein, because what is the relationship between an amino acid and a protein? Building blocks. Good. So when you hear proteins being made through protein synthesis, of course, that's the end goal, because amino acids are the building blocks for proteins. So let me explain a little bit about why we have to do transcription first. This is my unraveled DNA. Do you recognize? Chromatin. Yeah, so my unraveled DNA is sitting here in G1, and it doesn't need to be dressed up into a chromosome. It's not in the synthesis part of the cell cycle anyway, and we're not even close to being ready for mitosis again. So we've got this cell in its relaxed state of chromatin, and you notice that the chromatin is actually a fairly big molecule. So we're going to stick this inside of its storage site, and we know that storage site is the nucleus. And the nucleus is surrounded by a protective membrane called the nuclear membrane or envelope. What is special about the structure of that envelope?
It
has holes. It has holes, yeah. So there's a hole. You know, we got a couple of holes scattered throughout here. And I purposely drew those smaller than my chromatin because those holes are not big enough to let my chromatin leave the nucleus. So that means that my DNA is so large that it has to stay inside that nucleus. Well, if I want to transcribe and translate my DNA into proteins, I've got to find a way to get the message out here to the cytoplasm. So my first job is to select a piece of that DNA. We're going to take this one right here. And this particular piece of DNA is going to code for the protein that I want to make. I don't need the rest of this. The rest of that codes for other stuff. We don't care about that right now. We only care about making this one protein coded by that piece of DNA. I can't cut that out and take it out here into my cytoplasm because I would destroy my blueprint. You know, my DNA is my blueprint for my cell. So what can I do to take a piece of that DNA out into the cytoplasm?
Rewrite
it, good. What should I rewrite it into?
RNA.
RNA, good. So here inside the nucleus, I'm going to do trans what?
Transcription.
Good. So that's my nucleus. Okay. You know what? If you take the DNA's copy called RNA out into the cytoplasm and it gets destroyed, so what? Because you have the original blueprint safely hidden where?
Inside
the nucleus, right. Anytime you need a copy of your blueprint, you can just go and transcribe one from DNA into RNA. So, yeah, if the RNA gets destroyed, who cares, right? Go back and make yourself as many copies as you need, as long as your DNA is intact and safely stored inside that nucleus. I don't have a lot of room over here, so I'm going to take you back to this side of the board, and I'm going to write up here a strand of DNA that we're going to select. And I'm just going to pick that little piece of DNA, and we're going to transcribe that into RNA. So keep in mind, we're going to rewrite this into a different language. That's, of course, the whole point. And the point is to make a copy of our DNA that we're going to let escape through one of those nuclear pores into the cytoplasm. When we do the transcription process, we have to remember the base pairing rules. A's and T's normally pair together in DNA, but this time, what are we replacing thymine with?
Uracil.
Good. So A's are okay when we do RNA, okay? But this A normally would have paired with a T, but we don't have T in RNA. What do we have?
Uracil.
Yeah, get rid of that and put yourself a uracil there. Okay, let's see. C's and G's go together, so that's easy. Nothing has changed about that. What about the next set here?
G.
Good, okay. And then C pairs with G. T pairs with A. Good.
U.
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 A. Yeah. Okay. So let's have a conversation about the RNA that we just made. First of all, what stands out and says to you, I am not DNA?
U.
U's for uracil. Good. So when you see a strand like this, you say, hey, that looks funny. It's got U's in there. U's are never found in DNA. U's are only found in RNA. What process just made this strand of RNA?
Transcription.
Transcription, good. What is our whole goal? What are we trying to make here?
Proteins,
good. So we just took one strand of the DNA that codes for our particular protein. We didn't need the whole set of DNA. Just take the little piece that codes for that particular protein that you want to make. Okay, so I just want to emphasize that RNA is a little different from DNA. RNA tends to be single-stranded. Yep, that suits what we've got here. Okay, RNA has adenine, guanine, cytosine, and uracil. Yeah, so no T's in RNA. And one small difference here just to notice, sugar has changed. In RNA, the R stands for
ribose.
Good. So there we go. We've got ribose as our sugar, not deoxyribose that we saw in the DNA molecule. In fact, three types of RNA molecules. We just made one of them. It's called mRNA. That M stands for?
Messenger.
Good. What does the messenger carry? The code, right? Codons, good. You've probably heard the message before, the story before. Don't shoot me, I'm just the messenger. I'm just telling you what you need to know. And so the messenger RNA is carrying a code. And it has no idea what the code is. It's just, I was told to bring you this code. Now, the code is built into groups of threes. So if you can count off by threes, you're good to go here. A, U, G, that's 1, 2, 3. I'm going to draw a line so that we don't get confused, because it's real easy for your eyes to jump. G, G, C is another set of three. I'm going to draw another line. G, A, U. And then finally, UAA. So we've got our codon separated there. And those are the codes built into our mRNA strand. Okay. So I'm going to go back to our picture for just a moment and add to what we've done. We just took our mRNA out of the nuclear pore. Okay. We just made it as a result of transcription. All right, so I know you guys have looked ahead at organelles. What are the organelles that make proteins?
Ribosomes.
Good. Is there another one?
Rough ER.
Good. So you're right. Rough ER and ribosomes. Well, ribosomes are found on rough ER, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so no matter what, we're heading to a ribosome. And I wanted to tell you about the ribosome because it's actually our second type of RNA.
It is called ribosomal RNA, or for short, it's called rRNA. Good. So, you know, we're all about food today. And so this is a hamburger bun. This is what makes up our rRNA. rRNA looks exactly like a hamburger bun. It's got a big bun on top and a smaller one on the bottom. We call those the ribosomal subunits, but nonetheless, they're called rRNA for short. So we know that rRNA is where we make our proteins, and of course, R stands for ribosome. Not yet. No, keep me in check because sometimes I get to going and we forget something. Okay, so the point of having a ribosome is to give you a site for your translation process to occur, because we know translation occurs out here in the cytoplasm. What does translation rewrite RNA into?
Amino acids.
Good. So the rRNA, the ribosomal subunits, just give us a location or a substrate to make this happen. So you can see that our mRNA strand kind of slides through like a hamburger patty between the top RNA bun and the bottom RNA bun. What's that? Oh, you're right. Good for you for catching that. Y'all see what we're doing, right? Okay. Yeah, get those U's in there. And I know how to get that. Let's just erase that and start over. Okay, we'll just make, let's say, AUG. And we have
GGC.
There we go. Now we got I wanted to match what we had over there so you can see what was happening. Thanks for catching that, Taylor. I've had no sleep.
I understand.
Okay, one more component is tRNA, and it looks just like a clover leaf, right? Mm-hmm. And you know when you go to the grocery store or any store, if you happen to look on the back of a product, they'll have one of those UPC symbols that looks like a bunch of lines. If there is no price hanging on the shelf, or if there is no scanner sitting somewhere in that store, then you're like, well, how much does this cost, right? So that's what tRNA, I can talk today, tRNA is, it is a scanner for you. So it comes along and it says, hey, you want to know what amino acid AUG is? I'll scan it for you, and I'll bring you the price. Well, the thing that we're looking for here is amino acids, because that's what we're ultimately making. So you and I are going to play the role of the transfer RNA. We're going to actually look up the correct amino acid, and we're going to start building a protein based on the codes built into these codons. Keep in mind, these codons are separated into groups of threes, and of course, that's what a codon is. I have had people tell me almost every semester they're condoms. You know, they're not. Okay, they're codons. They'll misspell them that way on a test every time. But if you look with me in your course pack, let's see, bottom of page 30 has a codon chart. These two are actually the same. They're just written in different ways. I think the one you've got in your course pack is probably easier to use. But if you'll spend a moment for me, look up AUG.
Start.
Good. Okay, everybody find AUG is start. Guess what that means? That's where you start, right? So AUG says, hey, start reading me here. Okay, and the next one is GGC, which codes for? Let's see, GGC, glycine. Okay, everybody with me? Next one looks like GAU, aspartic acid, that sounds good. And that is stop. which means
the end.
So I know start and stop seem pretty obvious, but that's what your tRNA is looking for. It translates. Oh, I start reading here, and then it starts building the protein by bringing in the amino acids. The T stands for transfer. So when it says, hey, AUG means methionine, it travels in the cytoplasm, picks up methionine, and then hooks it onto that RNA molecule. And then another tRNA comes over and says, oh, GGC, that codes for glycine. It goes and finds it in the cytoplasm and comes up and links it back up. So you've got these tRNAs that are each working as individual scanners, reading those codons, and then linking back up these amino acids. I do need to put a peptide bond in between each of these. Okay, you might recall that peptide bond is a special bond between each of our amino acids. And that's going to help us build our peptide or our protein. Hey, this one has only two amino acids in there. We're not going to count start and stop, right? Okay, so is this a polypeptide or just a dipeptide? Yeah, it's a dipeptide. It's not real fancy. Okay, so what we'll do on test day is I'll say, okay, here's a strand of DNA. I'm going to ask you to transcribe it. When you're asked to transcribe, what are you doing with it?
Rewriting
it into RNA. Good. What is the thing you should remember to do with the T's?
Replace
it with the U's. The next thing you may be given is a strand of RNA, and I'll say, okay, I've got a strand of mRNA, which is the messenger, and I'd like for you to rewrite that or translate that into amino acids. I'm going to give you the codon chart, so you guys do not have to memorize that thing. I know that's always a panic moment when I, look at this and you say, do I have to know this for the test? Absolutely not. Just be able to use it, right? So the one that's in your course pack is the exact same one that I'll put on your test. And all you have to do is just read it, translate it, and then pick out the right strand of amino acids. To make it nice and easy for you, I will include a start and a stop codon. So if you don't do the translation correctly, just be on the lookout. I'm going to have a start and a stop at the beginning and the end. Okay, so that'll confirm for you did it correctly. So I'd like to make sure you're good to go with this. This is how the test is going to be set up. It's two separate questions. Let me give you a moment to copy down a piece of that DNA, or you can use the whole thing if you want to practice the whole thing. And go ahead and transcribe into RNA and translate into the amino acids. And if I can help you, let me know.
here when you're ready to check. Good to go?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Would you like another? What's that? No, 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 I'll give you the charge.
Yeah.
If you want one more, I'll give you a moment to copy this one down. Okay, so if you haven't had a chance to check yet, here's your answers. Okay, so let's review. When you're doing protein synthesis, the first step in making a protein is known as?
Transcription.
Good. And what does transcription produce?
mRNA.
mRNA, yeah. So RNA is good, but mRNA is an even better answer. That's good. Let's see, translation, the second step, produces?
Amino acids.
Amino acids, good. What is the link between an amino acid and a protein?
It's a building block.
It's a building block, good. And when we're doing translation, we should always look for two specific codons that clue us into the length of that start and stop, right? So start and stop should be our clues to look for. Okay. Let's see, if we're looking at strands of molecules and we happen to see uracils or U's, is it DNA or RNA?
RNA.
It's RNA, good. And of course, if we've got T's in there, we automatically know it's DNA. Yeah, DNA has thymines or T's, RNA has uracil or U's, good. Just want to repeat, you guys don't have to memorize the codon chart, it will be provided for you on test day. And transcription is the first step, asking you to rewrite into RNA. Translation is the second step, asking you to rewrite into amino acids. Just two tricky words there to keep straight. Do you feel good about this page?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Anything I can help clarify?
So if you have, like, where this amino acid has two of the same,
like alanines?
Yeah. Would you ask us if it was what kind of peptide it was? Would it still be a
diphthyde? I wouldn't ask you that. That would probably be like, it's got threes of poly.
Okay,
that
even though it's the same.
Even though it's the same, yeah. It's like having twins and a different child. There's still three kids. Okay. Let's see. I'm hoping you guys have had organelles in the past, Bio 100, Bio 110 perhaps, high school bio. Did you have any questions on pages 31 or 32?
So are you going to ask us about the 9.0
combination? Rarely I ask that. That's not a... When I commonly ask, I can show that since you know you had a question about that one.
I did because it was on the quiz, but if it's not going to be on the test, I'm not going to stress about that.
I usually don't ask that one. I can show you just so we've covered our bases. Let's see, organelles.
Okay.
Gotcha.
It was kind of hard to find the correct answer.
Okay. Let's talk about that way we've covered this one. Let's see. On page 32, you'll notice there are centrioles near the top of the page. And I did want to mention these because they are hollow logs. They're made up of teeny tiny little straw-like proteins. You know, straw's hollow, right? And there's three straws together, and they're called microtubules. And there's three more, and you keep going around and around the outside. They're like three little straws all built together. And there's nine groups of three going around the outside. There's nothing here on the inside in terms of tubules, so the inside actually has none or zero. So when they talk about the arrangement of centrioles, they call it a 9+0 arrangement of microtubules. You're looking down into little straws. Each one of these is a drinking straw called a microtubule. So when you cut it apart, this is what you've got. They look like those Mexican donuts called churros. Mm-hmm. So that's what I think of every time I see these things. But nonetheless, these are very important for helping cells divide during mitosis. You've probably heard of the mitotic spindle apparatus. That is formed by these centrioles and their microtubule fibers. So these are really important not only for cell division, but also building the basis of cilia and flagella. So here you're looking at, it could be either one, a cilium or a flagellum. The base or basal body is in fact a centriole. That's the part that's embedded down in the cell. And the cilium or flagellum that sticks off the surface of the cell actually has a different arrangement. So the arrangement, let's see, that's probably our best picture, is not triplets around the outside, but pairs, you know, of microtubules with a pair on the inside. So they call this a set of 9+2 microtubules that form the actual body of the cilium or flagellum, whereas the basal portion there is formed by a centriole, which has a 9+0 arrangement like we saw here, okay? So the mental image that I have is like you build a building. If they dig out and make a basement, the basement is different than what the building is made of. You know, buildings are often made up of steel cables, steel, you know, beams. So the basement is the centriole, 9+0, and the actual building itself is a 9+2 arrangement of these tiny, tiny tubules, okay? So that's just the difference structurally between a centriole that forms the basal body versus the actual cilium or flagellum that sticks up that has a 9+2 arrangement. I imagine it needs more structure. It doesn't need a hollow inside because cilia are sweeping, and what do flagella do? Swim, yeah. So they're whipping back and forth like a tail. So they probably need a little more structure. They're a little more oomph in terms of their microtubules so that they don't collapse. So 9+2 and cilium and flagellum, the base is a 9+0 arrangement. That's the big difference there. Let's see, anything else I can help go through on those two pages of organelles? I hope that helps clarify the difference there. Okay. That would be good. Structure and function is good to know.
Can you go back to that slide with the protein that lets the things back in and out?
Oh, with like protein channels? Sure. Okay. I will not have a cell on there, but I may have select organelles. Like Golgi is a really odd looking one. Something that I'm hoping that you'll go, yeah, I know what that is. A couple of pictures, yeah. You know, we just looked at the sale scale for, you know, from the University of Utah. This is also a really great website from the University of Utah. Same place, they call it Amazing Sales. But I know this doesn't look very interesting from the screen up here, but you can actually play with this thing. You can make the cell membrane opaque so you can't see inside, and then you can make it transparent. And when you mouse over different portions, it tells me that's the nucleus, and then I can click in and it will tell me more about the nucleus. So if you, I know these organelles are sometimes hard to get to stick. If you need a little extra, you know, help with it, this is a great website that will help you practice all those parts. So once again, this is at the University of Utah, same place that sales scale is located at. So pretty cool website.
Will there be any like specifics when it comes to like the organelles that you'll have on the test, or is it just basic like
that's the kind of thing, like if you the major job, that's what you want to know. I might say what cell organelle is like the storage site for DNA, you know, nucleus, or where a protein made, where's two places proteins are made. You know, where do we package and modify things? That's Golgi. So if you grasp the major jobs, you should be covered for organelles.
Okay. And what they look like.
Yeah, and what they look like. All right. We work a little bit on page 35. We'll see how far we can go. We're going to look at membrane transport. So we're kind of getting into territory here that talks about how membranes work. So we just got through talking about this just about an hour ago. We know that membranes are very important for regulating what comes and goes out of our cells, and they are the sites for some chemical reactions to occur. We know that membranes are semi-permeable, or you can call them selectively permeable. Which portion of your membrane is picky about what travels into the cell?
Tails,
yeah. Those phospholipid tails that are on the inside, they don't like what?
Water.
Don't like water, yeah. So we consider those tails to be the portion that drives the selectively permeable nature of these phospholipids. So that's where we're going today. We're going to talk about some membrane transport. We'll get started with it at least. And to have a conversation, we need to have a little chemistry background as well. On your worksheet, you'll notice three terms there: solute, solvent, and solution. So if you've ever made something like sweet tea, or if you've ever sweetened your coffee, then you've probably taken some kind of sugar product and poured it into your drink. You mix it up and you've created a solution. So the solute is actually the sugar product, whether it's, you know, Splenda or sugar or some other product. It is a smaller amount that you put into your liquid portion, which is a bigger volume. So the solute is what we end up dissolving in the solvent. Same picture here. We're using salt and water. The salt is being dissolved by the water, so the salt is our what?
Solute.
Solute, right. And our solvent, of course, is doing the dissolving, therefore the water is your solvent. If you paint with paintbrushes, you probably have some kind of organic solvent like turpentine. You take your paintbrushes and you soak them in that turpentine and the paint should come off. So the turpentine is your solvent and your paint becomes your
solute.
Yeah, so the solute's a lesser amount, it's being dissolved. The solvent is your greater amount, it's doing the dissolving. So I've used about every example that I can think of that doesn't have anything to do with the human body. Let's now talk about the human body. In the human body, we have about 3% solutes dissolved in our blood plasma. So does your blood plasma behave as your solute or your solvent?
Solvent.
Yeah, it's doing the dissolving. So to repeat, we've got about 3% solutes dissolved in our blood plasma. That means our blood plasma behaves as our solvent. Things like carbon dioxide, potassium, sodium, other kinds of ions and electrolytes, they're dissolved by our blood plasma, and those items behave as our solutes. Okay, so the answer, or the blanks there on your worksheet, we've got, you know, salt water or carbon dioxide dissolved in blood plasma. Either way, your solute is your CO2. Your carbon dioxide, and your solvent is what?
Blood plasma.
Blood plasma, yeah. So when I say that our bodily fluids are about 3% solutes, does that make you think that we're extremely salty or not very salty?
Not very.
Not very, yeah. What number would make you think, gosh, we're just nothing but salt? Yeah, 60, 70% salts. Yeah. So at 3% salt, we're kind of like the ocean. The ocean's about 3 or 4% salt. So we are isotonic to the salt in the ocean in terms of how salty we are. Not a coincidence, right? Yeah, because life evolved out of ocean and ocean creatures, so not just random that we have about the same solute concentration as the ocean. All right, so we're going to first talk about passive and active transport. This basically fills in your slide at the bottom of the page. And if you'd like to copy it down, I'll pause here and give you a moment.
So I'd like to talk to you about passive versus active transport. When we hear the word passive, it kind of sounds like, you know, if you're passive about something, you don't really care, right? So, you know, I'm passive about the color of the floor in this room or the color of the chairs, you know, meaning it really doesn't involve a lot of my energy or my thoughts in those colors. Now, in terms of membrane transport, the word passive means there's no ATP or energy involved. We know ATP is an energy molecule, and if you can move substances without energy, we say that we're going passively, typically from high to low concentration. So I think of kids at the park, you know, if you like to ride the slides at the park, you're going to go with the flow from high to low concentration. And when you do that, there's no energy required. All you have to do is make your way to the top. And once you ride, you're going with the flow down to the lowest portion of that slide. Now, you know, I love to watch kids at the park. They always, you know, even adults climb up the slide because they want another ride down instead of just walking to the back and catching the stairs, right? So if you're going against the flow and climbing up the slide, you're actually working, you're having to exert energy to go against the flow from low to high concentration. And when you do this, you're no longer in passive mode, you're now in active mode. Does active transport require ATP?
Yes.
Yep. So I'm going to use X's to represent concentrations of solutes. We can pick, say, sodium, for instance. And when we say we've got high concentration, we've got lots of molecules tightly gathered around here. And when we say we've got low concentration, that means we don't have very many solute molecules or sodiums. So the goal is to spread these molecules from being tightly clustered into being evenly spread out or distributed. And when you do this, the goal is to spread all these particles out evenly, which is called equilibrium. If you're working against equilibrium, going from low to high concentration, all you're doing is taking a nicely spread field of solutes and you're clustering them together tightly. You're never going to reach equilibrium if you keep jamming all these solutes together in a tight place. Okay? So imagine if you'd come into the classroom today and I had taken all your chairs and put them over here on this side of the classroom, then most likely some of you would have pulled them away from the cluster over to where you could actually sit nicely. So you would have moved them from high to low concentration. Most of us don't want to sit where there's a high concentration of chairs piled right on top of each other. So our bodies work with both. We can do passive from high to low, or we can do active from low to high concentration. So we're not through talking about this. We're going to step through each of these examples. Diffusion, osmosis, and facilitated diffusion are examples of passive transport. And we're also going to work on Monday about solute pumping, exo and endocytosis as examples of active transport. All right, any questions on this page? So can you explain to me why diffusion in this image is a type of passive transport? Good. No energy required to go across the membrane. And what are we doing? High concentration to low concentration. So yeah, you notice in those arrows, what is different between diffusion's picture and facilitated diffusion's picture? Good. No help needed for diffusion. Looks like facilitated diffusion requires an integral protein. That, in fact, would be a channel, just an open doorway. What looks different about active transport? Good. Yeah, you're right. So there's ATP energy. Looks like we're going from low to high. So that definitely qualifies as an active transport method, not as passive transport. Okay. So I'd like to hit the three types of passive. We'll probably just get through diffusion today. We probably won't finish this. But when diffusion occurs, molecules spread from areas of high concentration to areas of low concentration. This is like when someone has gas at the dinner table. You hear it, and you know what's going to happen.
you can count down and that smell's coming for your nose, right? So just like gas is diffused through the air, molecules diffuse through the liquids in your body. And in fact, this is the major way that oxygen diffuses into your bloodstream and how carbon dioxide diffuses out of your bloodstream. So it's a really important feature of how our bodies work. But I do want to mention that membranes are not required for us. You know, you can diffuse through a bowl of water, for instance, or you've smelled gases diffuse through the air. So this is our ultimate goal, to spread those molecules from an area of high concentration out to areas of low concentration. And notice how they're evenly distributed from one another. What do we call this picture?
Equilibrium.
Equilibrium, good. What does that mean has happened to all those molecules?
They're spread out
equally.
Equal concentration.
Good. Equal concentration, they're spread out equally. Drive by farms in the summertime, and you'll notice rows of corn. They're planted the same distance apart, right? So they've put those corn plants at an equal distribution from each other, just like what you see here. Gases, solutes, solids all work by diffusion. All you need is a concentration gradient. That is the only requirement for diffusion to occur. So you just need an area of high concentration and an area of low concentration. And those molecules randomly move by kinetic energy back and forth and bounce off of each other. I do want to emphasize, though, that even though they bounce off each other by kinetic energy, there is no energy input required for the movement of those molecules. They're just randomly moving to areas of lower concentration. Let's see, below your worksheet there, or below your picture on page 36, number 4 says, what are some examples of substances that move by diffusion? I've mentioned 2 so far, carbon dioxide and oxygen. And a third one you could use there for letter B could be hydrogen ions. So carbon dioxide gas, oxygen, and you could even use hydrogen ions. Those also move by diffusion. All right, so let me emphasize something about diffusion. In order for molecules to diffuse, they've got to be tiny, because when they diffuse through your phospholipid bilayer, they squeeze between the heads and tails and work their way to the other side. They can diffuse into a cell. Molecules can also diffuse out of a cell. But nonetheless, in order to diffuse, you have to be tiny to squeeze through those phospholipid bilayers. Another issue about who can diffuse is based on the molecule's construction. What do those tails not like?
Water.
They don't like water. So can water diffuse through your phospholipid bilayer?
No.
No, those tails say, eh, you're not coming through. We don't like water. So you stay on one side or the other. So things like water or water-based molecules cannot diffuse through that phospholipid bilayer. How about fatty molecules? Do you think they can diffuse?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
They may need some help, but most of them can work just simply by diffusing into that cell through the phospholipids, either coming in or going out. So that's the catch, is our examples here have to be either small, like those gases and hydrogens, or they have to be a lipid, some type of fat, because fats can work through those phospholipids, and most importantly, those phospholipid tails like fats. So fats are going to be agreeable for other fats to move through. Okay, so just want to make that mention there about number 4. Yes, small stuff is diffusible and fatty items are diffusible. Let's take a look down below. Diffusion rates are affected by temperature and viscosity. Let's talk about temperature first. So the temperature of your body is around 98.6 degrees. That's an average number. Not all of us are sitting there dead center at 98.6. If you happen to have a fever, diffusion rates will increase. So that means gases, for instance, will move through your body more quickly. What happens when you're cold? They'll move slower. Exactly. So the blank there to fill in, it says cooler temperatures slow diffusion, while warmer temperatures
speed up.
Yeah, you got it. Speed up diffusion.
Yeah.
part of why you sweat, and you need more oxygen when you have a fever. So it drives all sorts of things when you're hot, you know, when you've got a fever. The other term there, viscosity, means fluid thickness. Yes, yeah, so can you tell me a thick fluid that you may have at home in the cabinets in the kitchen or the refrigerator?
Syrup.
Syrup, good, yeah. So if you've got some log cabin syrup or one of those type of maple syrups that you put on pancakes or whatnot. What's that? Corn syrup too, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Those syrups are viscous. Okay, water is not very viscous. Water's less viscous. Syrups are on the other end of that viscosity scale. All right, so viscosity influences the speed of diffusion rate. So you'll notice if you read along there with me, the thinner the fluid or the more fluid the environment, the more viscous or the quicker rather those molecules will diffuse through that very thin fluid. The blank there says, while the thicker the fluid, the slower diffusion occurs. Okay, so the thicker the fluid, the slower the diffusion rates. One major part of your body that contains fluids is blood. So if you have viscous blood, you're probably dehydrated. And if you're dehydrated, what does that do to your diffusion rates? Slows it down, yeah. If you're properly hydrated and your blood is really thin, lots of fluids in there, then your diffusion rates increase. So this is where we're heading with it. We're not just talking about this for diffusion in Bio-210. We're going to talk about viscosity again in Bio-211 when we talk about blood pressure. So it's a good topic to hang on to in your mind. Okay, so just at the bottom of the page, what are some things you've learned so far about diffusion today? No ATP is required. Good. Items have to be small or fats, right? Good, to go through the plasma membrane. Good. The goal is when equilibrium is reached, so we're hoping to spread these molecules out. That's at least three, right?
Mm-hmm.
So no ATP is required. Small and fatty items move easily by diffusion. And yeah, our goal is to spread this stuff out and call it equilibrium. Those are three good points.
Essay?
Osmosis is more likely your essay. You guys comfortable with osmosis? Okay. That's our topic starting off Monday morning, so we'll hit that. We'll hit some epithelial tissues. I'm going to try to leave you 30 minutes or more for questions for test number one. All right, y'all have a good weekend.